Well, hey, as we begin today, I've got a question for you. My question is this: what's making you anxious these days? What's keeping you up at night? What's causing you to lose sleep? Now, I know that that's a silly question. This is 2020. Everything is causing us anxiety these days, right? Because this is a crazy place right now. This is a crazy time that we live in. Everything seems to be causing us anxiety, whether it's the COVID crisis, and of course the question of what comes next. That's something that I'm anxious about these days. We have fears about the economy, about politics, about education, issues of race, justice. Our state is on fire. Nobody seems to be able to get along with one another. And on top of that, we have the worry about whether the San Francisco Giants are going to be able to hang on and make the playoffs this year. And on top of all that 2020 has thrown us as a group and things that we're all going through collectively, we also all have our own stuff as well, right? So you might feel like you're facing the giant of an illness, maybe yourself or a family member, or the giant of an addiction, maybe fear of finances or something with your kids or your job or your marriage or a friendship or getting older or what comes next in life, or, you know, I thought I'd be at a different place at this point in my life. Or maybe you just say, you know what, now that you say all that, it's all of the above. And thanks, Pastor Glenn, for bringing all this stuff up. I was feeling good until I started listening to you this morning. Well, here's the thing. We all know that these things can not only cause us anxiety, but these kind of giant fears can sometimes leave us feeling not only defeated, but even kind of paralyzed in life. And that is not God's heart for you, and that's not God's heart for me. We are not meant to live in bondage to worry and anxiety, or really we're not meant to live, of course, in bondage to any sort of sin. And so today in our study of the life of King David, we're going to look at that God provides a way, that God provides a way to move past those giants. And we are going to look today at the ultra important and ultra well-known story of David and Goliath. And the title of today's message is Goliath Must Fall. And I hope that that's your heart this morning, that whatever you're struggling with, that Goliath must fall. So our study, our series on David is called Chasing After the Heart of God. And this is one of those times where we see that David does just that. He chases after God. This is also one of the most well-known stories, of course, not just in the Bible, but one of the most well-known stories in all of history. In fact, there was an online poll that was done recently, just asking regular people about, you know, what's a Bible story that they know about. The number one answer was the crucifixion. The number two story, or number two answer, was David and Goliath. And the third story was the birth of Jesus. So in other words, David and Goliath actually beat out Christmas. And so it's definitely a well-known story. But the problem with a story like this that's so familiar is sometimes we kind of have what I would call the Pledge of Allegiance effect. And the Pledge of Allegiance is, of course, very important and powerful words. And yet sometimes when you say the same words over and over again, they sort of lose their impact. And sometimes you can just say those words without really feeling or experiencing the power of them and letting the power of those words sink in. And so what we're going to do today is we are going to dig into some of the powerful words from 1 Samuel chapter 17, which is where we find the story of David and Goliath. But I also think that you might be surprised to find how this story fits into really the overall story of the Bible. And it's actually my prayer today that you might even find yourself in a new way and in some new places in this story as we dig into it together. Because especially if you grew up around church, maybe when you first learned this story, you learned it, you know, with a flannel graph background, and, you know, David and Goliath were moved around on the little flannel board. Or maybe you're from the VeggieTales generation, and for you, David and Goliath are just, you know, a couple of vegetables. But I just wonder if there's something a little bit more than a children's story here. And so let's dig in to the story of David and Goliath, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, where we see that the scene is set, and we read this. Now the Philistines, gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah in Judah. They pitched their camp at Ephes-Damim, between Socah and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped at the Valley of Elah. They drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. So right away, we come to one of our first problems with a story like this, is all those names don't really mean anything to us, right? So you're reading along, Sokah, Azekah, Elah, blah, 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 and it all just, you know, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But here's what you need to know. I really think that the geography of Israel and that part of Israel is actually remarkably similar to the geography that we have right here in California. So if you zoom in with a Google image here, what you're going to see is along the Mediterranean, you have the coastal plains, which are the fertile ground there along the coastline. Then you have the coastal mountains, just like we have here throughout many places in California. And then inland, you have the inland desert, which is what we call Fresno or something like that. So 3,000 years ago, in the time of David, the powerful Philistines were the people that lived along the coastal plains. The Israelites occupied the less good coastal mountains. But the good thing was, at least there were places to kind of hide there and to find protection. And all along, there were places where the coastal mountains met the coastal plains, and they formed these valleys, like the Valley of Elah, where you could stand on kind of both sides and see what was going on in the middle of it. And you know, it's fascinating, especially for people out there that say the Bible is just a myth, or the Bible is just a bunch of made-up stories, that in recent years, archaeologists have actually uncovered some amazing ruins of this Philistine city that we read about, known as Azekah. And what we find is, in the archaeology that's come from there, is it's just like the Bible describes. It's a place that this powerful tribe of people known as the Philistines lived, and there were many bronze weapons and other technology of the day. And on the other side of this valley, they've uncovered places where the Israelites lived, and just like the Bible says, you see evidence of those places, but without a lot of the weapons and the bronze things that the Philistines had. You can actually learn a little bit more about that in this week's community group video, and it's really interesting. And so that's kind of the battlefield. Next, let's see what we learn about the giant himself. Verse 4 says this, "So there was a champion named Goliath who was from Gath, and he came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span." So again, we need to stop right there, because there's another problem. Nobody really knows what 6 cubits and a span is. We just know, again, from Sunday school or from VeggieTales, that this was some sort of giant. And most of us, when we think of a giant, we think of, you know, something out of a Lord of the Rings movie or something like that. And our minds quickly go to fantasy or fiction or something that is made up. So what we see is that the Goliath is described as 6 cubits and a span, which actually translates out to about 9 feet, which of course is, you know, extraordinarily large. And yet, this is a picture of a man by the name of Robert Wadlow. Robert Wadlow is the tallest person in recorded modern history. He was born in Illinois in the 1920s, and he measured out at 8 feet, 11 inches. And you can see a picture of him here with his dad. But I also should tell you that this same passage where we see 6 cubits in a span, there's other texts, ancient texts that you see even in like the Greek scriptures that were prevalent around Jesus's time, or in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where this phrase is 4 cubits and a span, which still describes a giant of a person, but it's closer to like 7 feet tall, or a little over 7 feet tall, which is, you know, the size of an average NBA player, or a large NBA player today, like you see here with this picture of Shaquille O'Neal next to Kevin Hart, who is 5'5". And ironically, Kevin Hart at 5'5" was around the size of the average person in the time of David's age. But here's something else that you should also see here as we talk about these giants. And you might want to write this down as we think about how this story fits into the whole Bible. And you might want to write this phrase down. There were still giants in the land. And what that means is if you remember the story, When Moses leads the people out of slavery in Egypt and towards the promised land, Moses and Joshua get the people right to the edge of the promised land, and they're ready to go in and to chase after God's heart and to live in that land, that good land that God had for them. But the report comes back that there are giants in the land, and the people are so terrified that for 40 years, they don't go into the land. Well, finally, they, led by Joshua, chase after God's heart, go into that promised land and begin to occupy the good land that God has for them. But as you read through the stories of Joshua and other places, we see that they don't completely chase the people out. And so here we are, generations later, and we see that the great-great-grandchildren are still dealing with the same giants, still dealing with the same problems. And if our lives, if Goliath is going to fall, right? If those giants are going to be defeated in our life, there has to be some urgency to really get rid of them once and for all. But here's something else that we should see. Let's talk a little bit about Goliath's weapon. So we know a little bit about the giant, but let's go back to verse 5 where we see this. Goliath wore a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. So that's over 100 pounds his armor was. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels, or over 15 pounds, and his shield bearer went ahead of them. And Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel there. And so we don't have time to get into all of the details of Goliath's weapons, but suffice it to say, this was the best and the most powerful weaponry of the day. And notice the author devotes a lot of time to describing Goliath's armor, right? He spends a lot of words there just going over all the things that Goliath was wearing in that armor that was there. And that's because for the reader, especially in David's time, they would have read all that and they would have thought there is no one that would have a chance against this picture that the author just painted there. Right? This was the end of the Bronze Age. These kind of bronze weapons were the latest and greatest technology. And on top of all of that, we just read a few chapters ago in 1 Samuel 13 that in that time there was not a blacksmith that could be found in the whole land of Israel. So in other words, they didn't have any of those weapons that the Philistines had. Now, it's interesting, especially as we talk about kind of the archaeology of this time supporting this event. There was found, even in some of the ancient Egyptian writings, so out of this, connected to the tomb of Ramses II, there are hieroglyphics that actually give a description of some of the most dangerous tribes of the region at that time. And a lot of them are names that nobody knows about, but one of the names that's listed there at the tombstone of Ramses II is a group of the sea people known as the Philistines, who were known as some of the toughest and the strongest and most advanced people of the day. And so the author wants us to get that picture, that there is no one in that day that could really go up against the Philistines, especially this giant with all of that armor. And we see that Goliath actually taunts the Israelites. Verse 8 says, Goliath stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, right? Am I not one of the strongest ones? Are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and I kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." And then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." And on hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And so for 40 days, this giant of a man comes out, decked out in all the latest and greatest battle gear. And he comes out and he taunts the Israelites and he insults their God. And the response of the Israelites is, they were terrified. They were terrified with anxiety. They were paralyzed with fear. And this is a very important part of the story. What we have here, and you might want to write this down, is what is described as champion warfare. Sometimes it's called representative battle. What Goliath was challenging them to was this champion warfare. And the concept of champion warfare is simple. Rather than full armies going up against one another, you send out your strongest guy, we'll send out our strongest guy, and the future of our people rests with that champion. Right? Because whoever wins, their people will rule over the others. And so that was the challenge that Goliath made to this champion warfare. Now, in this story, in 1 Samuel, there's a very clear person who should be the one that goes out and fights Goliath. Who is it? It's their king. It's the king of Israel, who is Saul at this time. Now, Saul is not 8 feet tall, but we're told several times that Saul was a head and shoulders taller than everyone else. And yet we see specifically that Saul was paralyzed with fear and terrified. But for 40 days in a row, Goliath comes out and he taunts Saul. And he comes out and he taunts the Israelites and their God. And what a pathetic picture that is. But that is what fear and anxiety can do to us, right? It can leave us paralyzed with the problem. And the problem doesn't go away. If anything, the problem just keeps getting bigger and bigger and more oppressive if nobody deals with it. And into that scene enters David. But of course, it's so interesting because David doesn't enter in as a great king. David doesn't enter in as a warrior. David enters in as the 15-year-old DoorDash delivery guy. We're specifically told that his dad sent him to the front line to his brothers to take them some bread and some cheese, right? And so David enters onto the scene and he sees right away that Goliath comes out and he's making these taunts and his brothers, along with everybody else, are just shaking in their sandals. Verse 24 says, when the Israelites saw the giant, they ran back to their tents in fear. But here's David, the food delivery guy, who comes out. And right away, we see that David starts to approach the situation differently. And let's just look at a few things that David does. First thing that David does is he focuses on the opportunity and not the obstacle. What do I mean by that? David comes out, and when he sees Goliath taunting them, his question is, hey, what does the guy get who goes up and fights against this guy? Right? He's looking for the opportunity. Well, they say, you know, hey, if you go up and fight this guy and defeat him, you'll be given riches, you get to marry the king's daughter, and you won't have to pay any taxes for the rest of your life. Now, I know what some of you are thinking about right now. You're thinking, seriously? No IRS for the rest of my life? I could go fight against the giant for that. But David focuses on the opportunity. His first response is not fear. His first response is, what can I do to defeat that giant? And what happens if I do? But his brothers start to criticize him. They say, hey, just, you know, drop off the bread and the cheese and go about your business. You're too small. You're too young. You know, you don't belong here. But what we see is that David actually ignores the criticism, and specifically ignores the criticism of his family, and turns aside to others. And what he does is he remembers that God had been faithful to him in the past. David was a shepherd, and as he cared about and protected the sheep, he says there was times that there would be lions or bears that would come and try to attack the sheep. And he says, but God was with me. And he says, the Lord delivered me from the paw of the lion, and the Lord delivered me from the paw of the bear. So he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. He remembers God's faithfulness in the past. And so he says, I'm going to go up and I'm going to fight this Goliath of a man. I'm going to fight this giant. And so Saul, who should have been the one out there fighting them, for whatever reason says, okay, we'll put our trust, you know, and our hope in this 15-year-old boy. And he puts his armor on him. And then we see that David just rejects the false protection of Saul's armor. So Saul's armor is too big for him. Saul's armor doesn't fit him at all. So he says, you know what? This is not going to be my protection. And so instead, he goes down into the river and he scoops up the 5 smooth stones and he takes his sling and he heads off into battle. Well, before we dig into and see what happens there at the rest of the story, I want to pause here and I want to look at three different approaches that we've already seen to handling fear. Because again, all of us are going to face challenges in life. All of us are going to face anxieties and fears. The question is not, are we going to face them? The question is, how are we going to deal with them when they come our way? And so I want to look at three approaches to fear. And the first one we see is Goliath's approach. And Goliath's approach is bold, bravado, kind of the self-confidence. If there was a phrase that kind of summarized Goliath's approach, it was this: I am the Philistine champion and you are the servants of Saul. I defy the armies of Israel today. So for Goliath, his whole approach was, they are weak and I am strong, right? Look at me. And so what you have here is a courage that he has, but it's an ego-centered courage that says, I can do this because I have more power than you. His hope was in himself and in his own power. It was like, you know, every pro wrestler you've ever heard say, you know, look at me, I can do this. Now we need to be careful here, because a lot of times, even you'll hear preachers kind of say that this is sort of the message of the story of David and Goliath. And kind of the message you should get is, you know, kind of like the, I think I can, I just need to be brave, I just need to be strong, I just need to believe in myself, and I can go out there and defeat the giants. And that is not the message that we see. That is kind of a Goliath-focused approach, where it is ego-centered courage. Well, next we see the approach of Saul. And if there's a phrase that kind of captures Saul's approach, it's this: when Saul and his troops heard the Philistine challenge, they were dismayed and they lost all hope. Because Saul's deal was this: they are strong. Look how big that giant is, and they are strong and I am weak. Now, on the one hand, this is a realistic approach that Saul has. He identifies that Goliath is strong. But again, his response is an ego-centered, it's all up to me approach. And so when he says, they are strong and I am weak, what you see is an ego-centered cowardice, where he says, I do not have the power in and of myself. But what I want us to see is the third approach, which is the approach of David. And David's kind of catchphrase is this: you come with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord whom you have defied. So for David, his response is, I am weak. Yeah, I get that this is a big challenge. He says, and I may be weak, but my God is strong, and God is strong. And so what you have is not an ego-centered approach, but you have a God-centered confidence. And he says, I can do this because I have God's power. And so with trust in God, David steps forward, no armor, just a sling and five stones. And let's pick the story back up in verse 45, where it says this: David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. And this day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And all those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And it's interesting that David's speech there is actually longer than the actual battle. Because again, the author, by showing us there, is pointing to that's where the power of the battle is. It's in that confidence that David has in God. Verse 48 says, as the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and he killed him. And I can only imagine what the other Israelites who were watching that scene unfold from up there on the mountains. As they were watching, they were maybe looking through their binoculars and they're saying, David, don't do it. David, you are too small. David, you are going to get killed. David, you are going to get us killed. And then when Goliath is down there, David just continues to run towards him. And you wonder if they're thinking, no, David, don't run. It's a trap. You're going to run and he's going to grab you and squeeze your little eyes out of your head. But whatever the others were thinking, that's not what David was thinking. Because you see, this brave, strong shepherd from Bethlehem, full of faith, kept running towards the Philistine champion. And he takes his sword and he lops off his head. And then he takes his sword and he takes his head and he brings it back to the Israelite camp. And here's the thing, for most of us, our whole life, we have heard that story and this is what we have heard. You have to go and be like David. That was the point of the flannel graph story that you heard in Sunday school. That's the point of the VeggieTales video and movie that you watched. If you have courage, if you are strong, if you have faith, then you can conquer the giants in your life as well. And from the most basic level reading of that story, that is true. David does give us an example to follow, and it is an example of courage and faith. But can I tell you something else that you've maybe never heard anyone else tell you before? In this story, especially if you look at it, not just in light of this story, but in light of all of Scripture, in this story, you are not David. That's right. You are not David. You are not the giant killer. You are not the one who can save yourself from your problems. You are not the one who can save yourself from the giants. You say, well, it's got to be up to me. If it's not me, then who is it? Who's going to slay those giants and those fears that I face day in and day out? You see, there would come another boy from Bethlehem, the final king in the line of King David. And like David, this king would be full of courage and bravery and faith. And like David, this king would be a giant killer. But unlike David, this King Jesus, the true giant killer, would go to the cross and he would lay down his life as a sacrifice for the sin of mankind. And after 3 days in the tomb, he would rise again to victory. And he would once and for all defeat the most powerful giants of them all, the giant of sin and the giant of death. You see, King Jesus is our champion. King Jesus is the one who we put our hope in. And because of that, because he is our champion, we can live in power and victory because he has won that victory for us. I don't have to slay my giants. He has slayed them on my behalf. In fact, there's this great passage in the New Testament in the book of Hebrews. In chapter 11, the author of Hebrews goes back and he talks about some of the great heroes of the Old Testament. And what he says is you should remember people like this. You should remember Abraham and Moses and Rahab and Gideon and David. And you should remember their faith and you should try to be like them. There is an example for them to follow. So remember them. And that's chapter 11 of Hebrews. Then you turn to chapter 12 and you read about another one. And this guy, we're not supposed to just remember, but we're actually told that we should throw off everything that hinders us and the sin that easily entangles us, and we should run with perseverance the race marked out before us. How? Not just remembering him, but fixing our eyes on him, with our gaze locked on this one who is the author and the perfecter of our faith. And the word that the author of Hebrews uses there is the Greek word archagos, that sometimes is translated as champion. Jesus is our champion. He has won the battle for us. And so I said, there may be some new places that you find yourself in this story, that you don't have to be David, right? I can relate to there's a lot of other places that I can find myself in this story. I know I relate to Saul and the Israelites when they cowered in fear. But you know what? As I read this recently, I saw myself in another character. And I wonder if you might see yourself in this character as well. We're going to finish up the story where in verse 51, we read that after David defeats the Philistine champion, that all the other Philistines turned and ran away. And in verse 52, it says this, After he'd killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. And when the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Verse 52 says, then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout, and they pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and the gates of Ekron. You see, the champion Jesus Christ has defeated our enemy and our giant once and for all. And now we can be like the men of Israel and Judah in this story, who with confidence that the enemy has been defeated, run forward in victory. But recognize that whatever it is that holds me back, whatever it is that stands towering over me, that Goliath must fall.